Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Please be seated. The court has three oral arguments for submission this morning. In the order that we will hear the causes, they are IHS Cedars Treatment Center of DeSoto and others versus Jody Marie Mason and others from Dallas County and the 5th Appellate Judicial District. Geneva Brooks and others versus North Glen Association from Harris County and the 6th Appellate District. And Henry Ray AIU Insurance Company, an original petition for writ of mandamus. In each of these matters, the court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument. The petitioner or relator may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by advising the marshal of our court. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each argument and complete these arguments before the noon lunch break. These arguments are being recorded by our clerk's office, and you may purchase a tape of any argument for close to a nominal fee. Justice Snyder is a liaison from our court or our bar at an international conference, and he is not here today, but he will be participating in the deliberation and decision of these causes. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioners in IHS Cedars versus Mason.
May it please the court, Mr. Charles Frazier and Mr. Daryl Nungo will present argument for the petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 4 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Charles Frazier will open with the first 16 minutes. Mr. Daryl Nungo will present rebuttal.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Respondent Jody Mason was injured in a one-car accident when the driver used faulty evasive action to avoid a dog in the road 40 miles from Cedars Hospital, 28 hours after her discharge. This court should reinstate the petitioner's summary judgments on the following grounds. First, their health care was too attenuated to Mason's injuries to have caused it. That is, no legal cause exists as a matter of law between their conduct and her injury. Secondly, Dr. Ramos owed Mason no duty to protect her from the conduct of third persons, not his patient, under these facts and circumstances.
This accident had happened 10 minutes and 1 mile away from the time and place of her discharge. Would the situation be different?
The legal cause, possibly, Your Honor, but the legal cause analysis contains several considerations, temporal and geographical being two of them, as this court held in Bosley, and would have to look at that to see. But the mechanism, the immediate cause of her injury was the car accident. The mechanism was evasive action that was negligent in avoiding a dog in the road. So if it were closer in time and closer in distance, we believe that the conclusion would not be any different because of the mechanism of causing her injury. This court has held.
Don't we have to presume for purposes of this record on summary judgment that it was not the dog that caused the injury but a psychotic episode?
No, Your Honor. We believe that that inference would be, that the Court of Appeals used was unreasonable because the affidavit testimony that she had a psychotic episode was conclusory and purely speculative.
Okay, but let's presume that it was not. Let's presume that it was competent summary judgment proof, and we had to take as true, and I understand you contest the underlying basis for it, but let's say we had to take as true that she did have a psychotic episode. Would your argument be different?
No, Your Honor. There would still be no legal cause for this reason. First of all, that affidavit, let's assume that that affidavit is competent evidence. When you see Dr. Kramer's affidavit, he said that her angry rage that Mason, the passenger, noted was consistent with a psychotic episode. And then Mason says she accelerated and then took the evasive action. He doesn't go further. He just says that psychotic episode was foreseeable. But he never opines or gives any statement in his affidavit that psychotic episode was a cause in fact of Mason's injury. So first of all, even if we take his conclusion as being probative, which we argue it is not. He doesn't go the step further, Your Honor, and say that it was a cause and fact. But secondly, what's critical, what's absent from this record, is Mason's mental state. Did it cause her injury? For them to prevail, they have to show that we discharged a patient that was mentally ill and that it was her illness that caused her injury. There is no evidence in this record of her state of mind when she got into the car. There's no statement in her affidavit that she knew she was in harm's way, she expected to be injured, that she had some thinking in her mind that when she got into the car with Thomas at the wheel, that she was in danger, that she was acting out her supposed passive suicide that was indicated in her medical records early after her discharge, or after her admission. So the absence of that evidence, coupled with Dr. Kramer's affidavit not going further into cause and fact, still supports our argument that there was no evidence, no fact issue on proximate cause.
Is it possible that Cedars Treatment Center and the nurse might be negligent when neither one of the doctors were? That is, that each doctor only had a duty to know about their own patient, but that the treatment center itself might have a duty to know about the interrelationship between these patients?
Well, there is, of course, there are cases where hospitals have a duty to protect their patients when they're in their care, custody, and control. That is the law in Texas and elsewhere. But the negligent act that Mason is asserting in her petition was the discharge. And, of course, the physicians discharged the patient. Dr. Ramos discharged Jody Mason, and Dr. Meyer, who's not before the court now, discharged Thomas. So that call is made by the physicians.
His name is still in our style, but we should take it out.
They were severed. His claim was severed, so he is no longer before the court. The plaintiffs, or Mason, they reached an agreement, and it was severed to the trial court. So the clinic, Minerva Meyer Clinic, and Dr. Meyer are not before the court. And so it is possible they have policies and procedures going up the chain of command, which is in their petition. But the discharge of these two patients is the crux of their allegation. This court, of course, has held that a person is not responsible for the remote results of his wrongful conduct. And therefore, there is a boundary, a line, separating cases where legal cause may exist and where it cannot exist as a matter of law. And this case presents the court with the opportunity to define that line in legal cause, and that is a legal question that the trial court can make. They argue that the affidavits usurp, take away that ability, and that when you have medical cases in which affidavits are necessary, or expert opinion is necessary, that you can't have legal cause. And that's just not correct, because in that instance, any expert could say, well, let's say the accident was 3 months later, and I think it's foreseeable, and go. A court can say, no, the ripples of someone's conduct, even though they continue on, their effect has to stop at some point in time, or else we could always be responsible.
Isn't there evidence that Dr. Ramos knew that there was a destructive relationship between Mason and Thomas? And isn't there evidence that he also knew that they were planning to spend time together? Can't that lead to at least an inference, and maybe not direct evidence, that knowing that they're going to spend time together and that they have both of them had mental problems, isn't there an inference that could have led to harm to Mason? With that respect to what kind of harm it would be?
Well, as to the first, the records, the medical records show that there was a roommate or someone, that there was an inappropriate relationship, as Nurse Marks opined or stated, and that she feared someone. Dr. Ramos was not told that they would be going out together. She mentioned a Cindy to him, but no one knew really, or Dr. Ramos didn't know that they would be going out together. And the nurse knew that they would be spending some time together. But that does not change our facts, Your Honor, because Dr. Ramos, as far as he's concerned, did not know that they would be spending time together. He did not know Cindy Thomas. She was not his patient. And Nurse Marks knew that they would be spending some time together. She can't make the diagnosis.
But Nurse Marks told, isn't there evidence that she told Ramos that they would be spending time together?
She said in her deposition testimony in the record that she told Dr. Ramos that Mason will be spending some time with Cindy. And Dr. Ramos said, I didn't know who Cindy was. And again, we go to the, is there evidence that the mental conditions of both patients were a cause and fact of this injury? Even taking, if you assume Dr. Kramer's affidavit is probative on that point, the evidence doesn't reach that far. The court appeals.
Mr. Frazier.
Yes.
Assuming Dr. Kramer's opinions are competent summary judgment evidence, do you lose necessarily?
No, Your Honor.
Why?
Because even if competent on the issues he addressed, he did not address cause and fact, and secondly, he did not address, nor did any other person address, Mason's mental condition at the time she got into the car, that she got into the car because of her mental illness. They just skirt that issue. They don't address it. There's no evidence of that. And, Your Honor, they have to have that evidence, because if we discharge, their position is we discharge a mentally ill patient. And Dr. Kramer says that she was so bad off that she should have been committed under state court-ordered commitment proceedings. Instead of letting this adult woman with a child who voluntarily admitted herself into the unit, even though he diagnosed her as being non-suicidal, that she was okay, he wanted her to stay, but he felt he couldn't discharge her. Notwithstanding all of that, that he lets her out and he's not responsible for her conduct. But even assuming she was ill and she did get out, there has to be evidence that that illness, which is the reason why they claim she shouldn't have been discharged in the first place, was intimately related to her injury.
So if she herself had been driving and had a psychotic episode, you would say there would be liability here?
It would be a closer call, Your Honor. She's not in the direct care and custody and control of Dr. Ramos. The cases that talk about protecting people from their own harm, as well as the harm they may cause others, deal with the right of control if they're in, like common carriers, innkeepers, patients who are inside the hospital. So that would be a different case, not this case, but it could be a closer argument of liability if it was, in fact, her mental injury that caused the accident. This case is just as attenuated. If Mason were walking down the street and a wayward car hit her, she was out, yes. But for our discharge, she would not have been there. But that, of course, is just setting up the condition. And their position is, and you see Dr. Kramer's affidavit, it's all about she would not have been in the car. She would have been inside. In fact, on page 35 of Mason's brief, she says that if we had discharged her after 96 hours, then there would be no cause and fact, and there would probably be no negligence.
Which goes to the point of one of respondents' arguments, which is that Dr. Ramos is at least in part responsible, is the argument, because he discharged Mason at the same time as Thomas. And as I read the briefing and some parts of the record, it does seem to indicate that Dr. Ramos did not know that the two were being discharged at the same time. But he also, as I recall, testified in his deposition that it would have been appropriate for him, and he had a duty to learn that or to know that, didn't he?
He said that if the two patients were suicidal and were going to kill themselves, that it would be something that he obviously would want to know about. That's what his testimony is in his deposition. And he did say that he didn't think it would be appropriate for any peer to be discharged at the same time. Of course, he did not know that they were discharged at the same time. But the duty here, if I may segue from your question, the duty issue here, the rest of my time, he didn't have a duty.
Actually, let's stay focused on causation
okay.
A little bit here. The point I just raised is one of the two reasons why you argue Dr. Kramer's opinion, even if legitimate summary judgment evidence does not end the case against you. The other one is that there was no testimony from Dr. Kramer that any of the conduct of your client, Dr. Ramos, was the cause in fact. As I read it, Dr. Kramer says that based on reasonable medical probability, the aforementioned breaches of the standard of care constituted negligence and were a proximate and foreseeable cause of the injuries suffered. Are you saying that that statement does not touch on cause in fact?
No, Your Honor. It's a conclusory statement. Just like in the Duff versus Yellen case and Earl versus Ratliff, a conclusory statement that here's the negligence, it was approximate cause, is not probative. He never ties in how he can make a diagnosis of a psychotic event based upon angry rage.
Let's assume that it's not a conclusory statement and it is admissible summary judgment evidence. And let's assume that your issue about no testimony from Dr. Kramer, no expert opinion about Mason's illness leading to the accident, is a non-issue. Okay? So again, yeah. Let's assume Dr. Kramer's expert opinions are admissible. Is there any basis for considering that an expert's opinion, even if admissible on causation, may still be too remote to make causation established or to raise issue of fact on causation?
Yes, Your Honor. Our position is that notwithstanding expert testimony, even if the court considers it, this is a question of law, that remoteness is too remote. You can have expert opinions all day long, but if the facts they're undisputed about the cause of the injury versus the discharge, they're too remote, they're too distant, they're too attenuated, then the expert evidence, the expert affidavit, is just not material. It's a question of law. So even if the court considers his affidavit as probative evidence, otherwise competent, it's still legal cause, and it's not material. This is a car wreck case. Experts' opinions do not impact this.
I understand. Would this be the first time a Texas court has said that, if we say that, in fact?
That
even with competent expert testimony that causation exists, that a court may say, that there still is too much attenuation between the incident and the injury for there to be causation.
No, Your Honor. Park Place versus Milo. There was an expert affidavit who opined a reasonable medical probability regarding the cause of death. And this court held in that case that notwithstanding that affidavit, which was otherwise probative or competent, meeting all the standards of an expert affidavit, still did not determine causation because the other evidence in the case supported the fact that the patient only had a 40% chance of survival. So in Park Place versus Milo, Earl versus Ratliff, the expert just went on about negligence, and it was not probative. So there are two other cases.
In those two cases, did the expert opine that there was causation?
In the Park Place versus Milo case, Your Honor, yes.
And Ratliff?
In Ratliff, that was primarily, I think it was also causation, but the court went off primarily on it was conclusory as to the standard of care.
So it's your position that Dr. Kramer's testimony is not admissible, not competent evidence, and you win. And the alternative, even if Dr. Kramer's expert opinions are competent to be considered, you believe there's still room for you to win?
Yes, Your Honor, because it does not usurp the court's ability to make a determination as a matter of law that the injuries are too remote from the conduct of petitioners.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Charles McGarry will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. This court has held repeatedly that it will not amend or revise the rules of civil procedure by opinion, and yet that is exactly what the petitioners in this case are asking this court to do. Rule 166A(c) clearly says that as to any subject matter concerning which the trier of fact must be guided solely by the opinion and testimony of experts, a summary judgment may be granted only on the uncontroverted testimonial evidence of an expert witness. The same rule also says that if the witness, that summary judgment may be based on the testimony of an interested witness only if that testimony is free, clear from inconsistencies, positive and direct, and could have been readily controverted. This is exactly that type of case. We're dealing with proximate causation in a medical malpractice case, which must be guided by expert testimony. The only expert testimony that the defendants offered in this case was their own affidavits. They did not hire experts. Their own expert affidavit testimony was purely conclusory. They both denied causation and foreseeability, but they themselves did not state any reason why it was not foreseeable or why there was no causation. Their own opinions were far more conclusory than anything, any standard they asked this court to hold our witnesses to.
Does your case depend on some proof of a psychotic episode? In other words, if she had been in the car with Thomas, who had just swerved to avoid a dog and had the accident, you wouldn't have a case.
I think that's an important part of this case because, in fact, the eyewitness testimony in this case, and I think, Judge, you are right in that they are misapplying the proper standard of review in assisting on a version of facts that is favorable to their motion, which is completely contrary to the proper standard of review, that this court must accept the facts most favorable to the non-movement. And the facts in this case are based on the only eyewitness testimony available, which is that the driver, Ms. Thomas, went into an uncontrollable angry rage as a result of Ms. Mason's affections towards the third passenger, Mr. Cleveland. If that set off the driver, the fact that she went into this uncontrollable rage is completely consistent with the long-documented medical history of this patient, Ms. Thomas.
And presuming that being the case, what if Ms. Thomas had not been a patient at IHS, had just been a friend from outside? I mean, does your claim also depend upon the fact that they were subject, Thomas was subject to some supervision at the same facility?
I'm not prepared to say that would destroy the case, but it would certainly make it far weaker. I think that's an important part.
Weaker in terms of attenuation?
Weaker in terms of foreseeability. Because what we have here, and what I think is important for this court to remember, is that every single psychiatrist who testified in this case, including Dr. Ramos himself, testified that under the facts, it was not proper to discharge these two patients together. Dr. Ramos said that if I had known of their relationship and if I had known they were being discharged together, I would not have discharged her.
Well, and did he have any duty to know of their relationship?
Yeah, I would say yes, for two reasons. Number one, because it was in the medical history. The medical history reflected the unhealthy relationship that Ms. Mason had with another patient. The nurse in this case, Nurse Marks, knew of the relationship. In fact, the thing to remember is that Ms. Mason and Ms. Thomas were roommates. They were roommates at this hospital.
But is a doctor charged with knowing?
Yes, because the protocol.
Who his or her patient's
roommates? Dr. Ramos originally filed a summary judgment affidavit in this case in which he had contended that this discharge was against medical advice. The proper protocol when a discharge is against medical advice is to have a personal interview with the patient to discover the circumstances of the discharge. And he did not follow that protocol. He didn't even so much as ask to talk to Ms. Mason on the phone, even though Ms. Mason was standing right by the nurse when the nurse called this in.
But if he had, you'd still have a case.
Excuse me?
But if he had, you'd still have a case.
Well, he says that if he had, there would be no discharge. And so, I mean, the inference there is that if he had, she would not have been discharged. The cause, in fact, in this case couldn't be clearer. And I think, Mr. Frazier, with all due respect, misrepresented the law or misstated the law. The expert, our expert in this case, Dr. Kramer, did not say that commitment proceedings were necessary or advisable. The governing statute at the time made the 96-hour hold automatic. No legal procedures were required. Every doctor in that circumstance who determines that a patient is at risk has the authority to hold that patient against their will for 96 hours. In addition to the statute, the contract that Ms. Mason and all the patients sign when they admit themselves voluntarily to this hospital grant that power contractually to the hospital and to the doctors to hold them against their will.
But at some point, he's got to let her go. I mean, he's got to let her go at some point, and she's going to be responsible for her own actions, isn't she?
Well, everybody says in this case, and again, including Dr. Ramos, that if you knew the facts, you had a duty not to discharge them, to do the 96-hour hold. The purpose of the 96-hour hold is to allow time to begin the legal proceedings necessary for an involuntary commitment for a greater period of time.
Do you agree with the statement that in order to recover, you have to show that Mason's mental illness caused her injury?
No, I think that's a part of it, but I don't think that's exactly what we have to show. I don't think that's necessary. In this case, the danger was the circumstance under which she was being released. And in fact, I think the evidence does show that her mental illness played a large role in the danger that that all the doctors foresaw. Now, you have to remember that the definition of a discharge against medical advice, AMA, is that the doctor reaches a conclusion that the patient is a danger to herself or to others. And so for Dr. Ramos to say this was an AMA discharge, he is admitting that Ms. Mason at that point in time was a danger to herself.
Because she's mentally ill. Don't you have to connect those dots between her mental illness and the injury?
It was. And I tell you exactly how it was. You have to remember what all the experts in this case said. It was the joint discharge. It was two factors which by themselves may not have caused the injury, but when combined were certain to cause the injury. What you had here, and this is all documented in the medical records, is you had a patient, Ms. Mason, who was diagnosed with severe depression to the point where she lacked any ego whatsoever.
What if this had been her husband? What if there was documentation in her record that she had had arguments with her husband over the last 5 years, and she asked to be discharged, her physician discharged her, and then she and her husband got in a fight and he wrecked the car? Now, would this be any different?
Well, the immediacy might be slightly different, but no, the analysis is basically the same. A doctor who's discharging somebody in the circumstances of against medical advice has a duty to learn the circumstances of the discharge. Who is the patient being discharged to? Is the patient being discharged into a safe environment or into a dangerous environment? And if the dangerous environment is at home and it's the husband coming to pick her up, I think that's just as dangerous as discharging her in the company of a psychotic. But I mean, we have a more extreme case in this case. We have a discharge into the care and custody of a dangerously delusional psychotic.
What evidence is there that Dr. Ramos knew that she was being discharged, as you put it, into the custody of someone who was mentally ill?
What if he did know?
Where is the evidence that he knew that she was being discharged, as you put it, into the custody of someone who was mentally ill?
The evidence is that he should have. Now, there is controverting evidence, and this is the main point I wanted to start with, actually, and I kind of got sidetracked. But 166A(c) says that their expert testimony has to be free from inconsistencies, and it has to be readily controvertible before you even start looking at the respondent's evidence in this case. And their evidence was wholly inconsistent. Both the doctors, Dr. Ramos, both contradicted himself, but he and Nurse Marks contradicted each other on all of the facts regarding this discharge. Dr. Ramos said it was AMA. Nurse Marks said it wasn't. Then Dr. Ramos starts to try to retract his prior testimony that it was AMA. The medical records in this case were altered. The original medical record chart entry regarding the discharge says discharge pursuant to patient request and doctor order. The part regarding doctor order was crossed out. Finally, the witnesses contradicted each other on what Dr. Ramos was told. Nurse Mark said, I told him that she was being discharged with Cynthia Thomas. And Dr. Ramos said, well, you know, I didn't put two and two together. That didn't register to me. I had no idea who that was. Well, he had a duty to ask. That was his duty. He failed to do it. He should have known. Nurse Mark said he did know. He denied it.
What if the accident happened 3 weeks later?
I think cause and fact depends in large part on the fact that the accident occurred within 96 hours, which goes to the whole remoteness issue. Remoteness has to be measured in context. If we're talking geological issues, you know, you could have something happen 10, 20, 100 years away, but geologically it's not remote. Here in this particular case, I think the standard of remoteness is the 96 hours that these doctors had a duty to hold this patient for.
What if they discharged them 8 hours apart and the accident happened 98 hours after Mason was discharged?
Well, I think the cause, in fact, would be much weaker because it was beyond the 96 hours. As to whether the discharge was negligent because it was separate by 8 hours or whether it was not negligent, it would depend on the other facts of that situation.
Wouldn't
Who was she being discharged to?
Wouldn't you be saying that he should have been voluntarily committed her? Every step we go, your argument basically is it's saying if you've got someone who's voluntarily committed themselves, a physician, unless they're absolutely sure they're not a danger to themselves or others, should move for voluntary commitment.
Well, absolutely not. Dr. Ramos admitted that he should have committed her. He admitted it. He said, if I had known about their relationship and if I had known they were being discharged together, she shouldn't have been discharged. End of story.
He admitted she shouldn't have been discharged. Involuntary commitment. Basically you're saying anytime you've got a patient who's depressed or who has a history, that to protect yourself as a physician, don't you have to ultimately seek involuntary committal just to make sure that you're...
During that 96-hour period, you have to. But for the 96 hours, you don't need to do anything. The doctor has unilateral authority both under statute and
But if you
contract.
Let her go at the end of the 96-hour period, you're still liable if you didn't seek to involuntarily...
It depends on the patient's circumstance. And the thing you have to remember is that these opinions, Dr. Ramos's opinion or Dr. Kramer's opinion, are based on the medical history of these specific patients. And what you have to remember is that the medical records for Jody Mason showed that in the hours and days immediately preceding her discharge, she suffered significant deterioration in her mental capacity. That's documented in her medical records. She was going downhill at the exact moment of her discharge, and her doctor knew that. It was in her chart. That was why he admitted so freely that I shouldn't have discharged her, given that she was in a deteriorating state, had I known that she was being discharged with somebody who would take advantage of that deteriorating state. And that's exactly what happened.
Mr. McGarry, let me make sure I'm clear on your answer to the examples that were posed. If Dr. Ramos had held Ms. Mason for 96 hours and then discharged her, and assume all the other facts of this case are the same, would there or would there not be liability?
It would depend on Ms. Mason's state at the moment of discharge 96 hours later. He had assessed her.
Okay, let's assume that the discharge then was valid and supportable based on reasonable medical probability.
She would have had to have experienced significant marked improvement in her condition in those 96 hours, plus the circumstances of the discharge would have to be different. I don't think it wouldn't fly if she was being discharged with somebody who was dangerous. She was being discharged with a dangerous person.
I'm assuming all the other facts of this case are the same. So Thomas was discharged, under my example, 96 hours before Mason. And assume Dr. Ramos made a personal inspection or evaluation of Ms. Mason at the 95th hour and then discharged her. Then all the other facts are the same, liability or not.
A much weaker liability case, I can't speculate how it would be viewed under that alternate scenario, but it would be obviously a much weaker liability case because we are, in fact, relying on the fact of her mental condition at the moment of discharge in this case and the circumstances of the discharge in this case.
I understand, and we do have an important obligation as a court to resolve this case. And
right.
We're going to do that. We also have to look at the effects of this case and the causation arguments that both sides are making here. In fact, where do we draw the lines? And that's what I'm asking you to help us
do
we draw the line?
I want to address that point because as kind of an aside, but I think one of the important issues in this case that Cedars raises in its brief that I actually agree with is that the substantial factor analysis that this court engaged in the Union Pump case and its progeny created a lot of confusion for the bench and bar because I think the bench and bar remain uncertain as to the relationship between the substantial factor analysis and the traditional foreseeability analysis. And to resolve that confusion, I would submit to this court that it should accept Justice Cornyn's concurring opinion in Union Pump that these concepts are in fact one and the same. That if you look at the history of proximate causation, the notion of foreseeability was added to the notion of legal proximate causation in the Palsgraf case going back 75 years to address the very same issue of remoteness that the court sought to address with the substantial factor analysis in the Union Pump case. Just as a matter of theory construction, using Occam's razor. It's just bad theory construction to use two different concepts to address the same problem when one concept will do.
Does that resolve your problem? You're saying have the same standards, but instead of a two-prong test, a one-prong test, we still have to deal with attenuation, whether the incident was complete, and where we draw the lines here between an act and causation with the accident. So what you're saying really begging the question?
No, to that extent it does. And let me go further one step and answer your question. In this particular case, where you draw the line is that if there is competent expert testimony on the issue of causation and foreseeability that's admitted into evidence, that is the line, that the court must be guided by that expert testimony.
Without any regulation other than the fact that a competent expert, was this expert, by the way, challenged in the Robinson-Happener hearing?
No. And that would have been the proper procedure to follow if somebody thought this expert's opinion was completely off the wall and unsupportable based on the psychiatric science available. That would have been the proper procedure.
It
was not done in this case.
Are you saying that if an expert is qualified and there's a reliable basis in fact for their opinion and they have sound methodology, that courts of the state of Texas are bound to accept their expert opinion on causation?
Absolutely. And this court has held that consistently for over 50 years, dating back to the Bolt.
Let's test that. What if your expert had said this accident had occurred 3 months after the discharge, and you found an expert who would say that a reasonable medical probability, had you not discharged them together on that day, this accident 3 months down the road would never have occurred? Are courts bound by that?
The remedy is a Havner hearing. The remedy, the opinion is that off the wall, the remedy is a Havner hearing.
He's got the credentials. He says, but this is my opinion based on treating all of these patients all of these years. 3 months down the road, this was foreseeable.
I think that's necessarily true, because think about it. I mean, there are so many fields of science and expertise. For a judge to say, well, that's just too off the wall for me, I can't buy that, puts you in the position of being a super expert. And some of the examples I provided, in the field of geology, if somebody drills a gas well and the issue is, was that a substantial factor in destroying a geyser that's 100 miles away 6 months later? Well, how is a judge going to decide that based on the judge's knowledge and experience? Why doesn't the judge have to be guided by expert testimony on something that a layperson may think there's no connection whatsoever, but to an expert there's a clear connection? In quantum physics, I mean, there are results, observable results in quantum physics that just defy common sense and logic about things being in two places at one time. It defies common sense. A judge is not qualified to supersede an expert on those issues.
Let me ask you a quick question. In addressing the causation piece, in order to address that, do we have to know how the duty is being defined? In other words, it strikes me from your argument that you're defining this duty as a duty to protect someone from dangerous third parties. And that seems to me as though it would lead down one path to review the evidence on causation. But if you define the duty as to not release a mentally ill patient to protect her from injuries that might be caused by her own mental illness would be another path. Mm-hmm. And it strikes me from your argument, you're not going the latter route, because you would concede her own mental illness did not cause her injury.
I think you have to accept the duties laid out by the experts. Because, number one, the trial court specifically denied summary judgment on those issues.
I think you're misreading my question. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. I'm not saying... I'm trying to define the duty in terms of how we proceed with the causation piece. I understand that if you've got a doctor who testifies, you should not release a mentally ill patient, and you should have known about this interrelationship between the two. But if the duty is not to release a mentally ill patient, then in order to address the causation piece, we'd have to look at evidence that her mental illness caused the injury.
Well, it was a contributing factor, which I think all of the expert testimony admits that. It's just because of her interrelationship with the other patient. Her particular mental illness rendered her particularly susceptible to being injured by others. Her illness was a lack of ego and an acceptance of the risk of being injured by others.
But that my understanding is there's no evidence her mental illness, that she did anything as a result of her mental illness that caused the accident.
Her mental illness is the reason she wanted to go with Cynthia Thomas. She was bonded to her. She was following her like a slave.
But no evidence that her mental illness caused the automobile accident.
No, but I don't think we have to show that. We have to show that her mental illness caused her to be in that car.
Mr. Mr. Gary, I know you're out of time. A couple of final questions. Does the fact that this is a medical negligence case, in your opinion, change any of our analysis about causation when we have Union Pump and Lear Sigler and other cases that lay a framework for considering
that, that's
causation?
Exactly the last point I wanted to touch on, if I may. I think Union Pump did not change any of the analysis as to cases on which the trier of fact must be guided by expert testimony for this very simple reason. If you look at the substantial factor analysis that's laid out in Union Pump, substantial factor is defined from the point of view of a reasonable man, just like it is in every normal negligence case. Substantial factor in whose judgment? Well, in a normal case, in the normal judgment of a reasonable man as found by the trier of fact, where it recognizes that there are some cases in which reasonable fact finders couldn't disagree. However, when you're dealing with a case in which the issue of causation must be governed by expert testimony, the substantial factor analysis can't be judged from the point of view of a reasonable man. It must be judged from the point of view of a reasonably prudent expert, just as foreseeability in these cases must be judged from what is foreseeable to a reasonably prudent expert. And so the Union Pump analysis has to be modified to change the point of view of who's measuring substantial factor, just like who to whose foreseeability is important. And in these cases, it is the foreseeability to the expert and the substantial factor opinion of the expert that must be controlled.
If Dr. Kramer's pertinent expert opinions are excluded, do you lose?
No, because, again, of the inconsistencies and conclusory nature of the defendant's own expert. They had the burden of proof. This was a traditional motion for summary judgment. They just simply didn't carry their burden.
Any other questions?
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court. Legal cause goes beyond cause in fact. It goes beyond foreseeability. Legal cause has policy implications involved in it, other factors that are the province of the court. Who is better qualified, I ask the court rhetorically, to judge a question of law that we find in Union Pump, that we find in Lear Sigler, that we find in Milo? Who draws the line? A paid expert?
Yes.
I'm sorry. Let me ask you again. Does the duty drive the analysis? In other words, if we were to hold that the doctor did have a duty to protect her from dangerous third parties, then it strikes me that there could be causation. But if you define the duty as not to release a mentally ill patient, there's no evidence that the mental illness caused the injury. So do we first have to address the duty question in order to evaluate the causation piece?
Your Honor, I don't think they're inextricably linked in the same way that I think there can be findings that something is foreseeable but yet not sufficient to constitute legal cause. I think it's the same analysis. The duty issue is tied in. Perhaps it's tied into foreseeability. But, for instance, we can have a case where something could be foreseeable, or we could get an expert to say something is foreseeable, but yet that does not constitute legal cause. And in this case, the fallacy is saying that the court has to be guided by expert opinion. At first, we were told this is a medical malpractice case. But then, as in the briefing and as opposing counsel stated in his argument, it could be a geologist. It could be an atomic physicist, I believe was one of the references in his briefs. It could be any subject that we could have a retained expert that could invade the province of the court, which is to answer questions of law. There's no case that says legal cause has now become a question of fact where the court must be guided by expert testimony. In fact, the Milo case that the court discussed earlier in petitioner's presentation proved exactly the opposite. The court did not need to accept expert testimony. And the important factor on causation in looking at this case is that foreseeability is only one of the elements. Even if you accept the medical evidence offered by Dr. Kramer on foreseeability, there is not a shred, a scintilla of evidence that ties the evasive action to any psychotic episode. The only eyewitness, and we do have an eyewitness in the record, I believe the name is Ernie Dillard, police report said they took evasive action to avoid a dog and overcorrected the steering of the Corvette.
While they were going over 100 miles an hour.
Your Honor, absolutely, they were speeding. But we know, we have angry drivers who speed all the time. That doesn't link up a mental disability, particularly with Jody Mason, that there is no linkage showing that because of her mental state, she was involved in this car wreck. In fact, if you accept opposing counsel's comments, because of her weakened ego, because of her passive suicide tendencies, her exposure to anybody, whether it be her husband who's in the clinic suffering from certain drug dependencies, whether it be to any person with a strong personality, any exposure at all is going to put her in harm's way. And that does not satisfy the concepts of justice and equity that this court cited when it was talking about causation. And I would refer to an interesting case, Kramer versus Louisville Memorial Hospital. This court quoted Chief Justice Riley from the Michigan Supreme Court and said, to protect the integrity of our goal of arriving at the truth, there must be some degree of certainty regarding causation. Kramer's instructive because this court also said there's no reason to treat healthcare providers any differently in Kramer. It said to dispense with this requirement, this court said, is to abandon the truth-seeking function of the law. There has to be certainty. I see my time is up, Your Honors.
Any other questions?
Thank one other question.
Yes.
Why did you use the term legal cause instead of proximate cause?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Why use the term legal cause instead of proximate cause? Why?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that the concepts are distinct. I believe that the traditional concept, in my mind, they're distinct because legal cause has a component of public policy element. It has a component of fairness, of equity, that there's no doubt that the traditional elements of proximate cause, foreseeability, and cause in fact, that those go into the analysis of legal cause, determining remoteness. But I do believe the legal cause analysis is broader. Now, whether that's a threshold step or just a portion of the analysis and the overall proximate cause, I suppose it's semantic. But I do think the concept of legal cause is broader because of the policy implications that are referenced in the cases, because of the analysis of remoteness, and because of the fundamental fairness that underlies the concept of holding people liable only for what they should properly be held liable for.
Do you read legal cause in a broader sense?
Yes, sir.
Proximate cause sense, or something narrower even?
No, I read Union Pump in the tradition of Paul's graph as using legal cause at least in a broader sense. I don't know if it's specifically defined as distinct from proximate cause, but I do think it has broader concerns. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the first cause. We'll take a brief recess.
All rise.